cattle wander the land, once in the grave, even though I live barren. Father, blame the drought, but the neighbour's cattle were fat. He even begged the neighbour for help, but returned with a deep sorrow in his eyes. He had no other choice. He had to take drastic measures. He killed every single head of the herd. Then the seasons changed, bringing storms of wind and snow. But only I survived the winter madness. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Alan. And now we have Finn McLeod.
This is a poem by a guy called Shane Coyzan, who does American poetry. You might have heard them. Every day, Grandma would come into my room and I would hear her say, "Rise and shine. The world is the window that holds the sign. There's help put it out there somewhere, young man." So I rose and I shone. I put on my shoes and I was gone. See, Grandma bought me my first phone. She said, "Don't bother calling the people that care. Call the people that don't. Don't bother calling the people who've taken up a fight. Call the people that won't." And I learned at a very young age where my grandma's rage came from. The entire congregation would not, never ask Grandma about God. I'd argue with her every day. All she'd say is, "Go down to the store, buy some light bulbs, and when you run out, buy some more, because the light at the end of your tunnel needs to be maintained. You can't let it be stained by their beliefs are better than your beliefs, and you can't agree to disagree because they're fucking wrong. It's not that you're strong and have gotten lazy, it's just that your vision is a little hazy. You're not sure what it is you want, but what you've got is all you need. It's all to greed. For every hypocritical church grower that won't walk past the beggars on the street because they can't spare a dime, Grandma, say fuck them. I don't talk to God because I ain't got time." And yeah, it struck me as strange, because every time brother would stop me to ask, "Hey, can you spare some change?" Because yes, I can. But I don't carry change around in my back pocket or around my neck in a chain in some locket. I carry change on the tip of my tongue so I can climb the rungs of a ladder to a better place. Forget about saving face, remember, save your grace. I carry change on the tip of my pen that seeps out every now and then in spurts of angry ink that make me think maybe the writing on the wall could use a little revision. Grandma told me, "Stop trying to calculate the difference between people. People don't need division. Gotta stick together, gotta love each other. Father, mother, sister, brother, uncle, cousin, aunt. Forget about the chance, the cheers, the jokes, the cheers. After 2,000 years, you'd think we know by now." Grandma said, "We will only find equality in our number of tears." And she was right. I don't know what injustices you suffered based on size, sex, race, religion, or the political pigeon shitting on the shoulders of us versus them, like in Bethlehem, where a man said, "Hey, I could be wrong, but can't we all just get along?" No. So we nailed him to a tree, see? Justice is injustice, it just is, and I can't change it, you can't change it, we just gotta rearrange it. And if I could give this miracle a chance to see, a chance to see what I see, to see the way that people see me, because if seeing is believing and you can see what I see, then you wouldn't want to see anymore. But I got a little surprise in the store. For every man that looks upon me with judgment in his eyes, there's a woman that looks upon me with wetness in her thighs. Greatest unimplied lover. And you might just laugh, you might just gulp, but my bones are made from sticks and stones, and then just pissed me off. Grandma said, "Young man, you can't be concerned about whatever it is they've got. The only reason they think they're beautiful is the same reason they think you're not. And young man, you have beauty beyond measure. You are a treasure entrenched in this earth. You can't let a stranger determine your worth. Rise and shine." So I rose in my shawl, I put my shoes away, and I was gone. See, Grandma bought me my first phone. She said, "Young man, from time to time I too need to smile. Will you do me a favor and put me on speed dial?" "Yes, Grandma, I will." And still to this day, I can phone her up and hear her say, "It's a game." Hear her say, "It's a game. You play, you win, you play, you lose, you play. Rise and shine. The world is the window that holds the sign. There's help going out there somewhere. But, young man, if you are playing to win, the first thing you must do is apply within."
Finn McCool. No, it was Finn McLeod. He's a giant of a man. He's like Finn McCool in terms of poetry, anyway. Do you notice there's a figure to my right now taking a guitar in his hand? That man is Alan Coakley. And he's going to do a little performance for us.
Do you want to listen to me practice my song?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
Woo.
Shrieking with a wild banshee's wail, I'll weather the storm, I'll tide on my sails. Now jump back to me and compare thee to a rose. I wouldn't, I shouldn't, I could, I suppose, but I won't, because softly and slowly I tread. I promise to be beside you whenever this poem is read. And this is a poem I wrote for a girl. If you were an ocean, then I'd be a boat, so that in you, around you, and on you I'd float. If you were a flower, you'd have the sweetest nectar. If you were a bus, I'd be the ticket collector. If you were a spaceship, then I'd be space, and all across the cosmos are the patterns we trace. As the heavenly bodies repel and attract, facts stranger than fiction, we become what we act. Venus, the goddess who don't give a damn, right now she's scribing a sky pentagram. As the 12 zodiacs spin round the North Star, would that we were so guided, could we perceive what we are? Have we lost our way amid science statistic? Forgotten we're creatures sublime, utterly mystic. If you were a car, you'd be sleek, shiny and fast. Tomorrow, today, would be in the past. The future's unwritten, we dream from our hearts. You see, everything's possible, life imitates art. And in my dreams of yours and your mine, now and forever, backwards, forwards in time.
Number 5 is Michael O'Donnell.
Strange poem to be reading this evening on International Women's Day, called The Man in the Glass. The story about this poem is very interesting. My girlfriend and I, many years ago in the old court, she was studying psychology and I was studying anyway. And so we went to an AA meeting, you know, to get the you know, research, as it were. And we said, can we have a drink before we go? And she said, no, it's not an AA meeting. So we're done anyway. And she said, there was people in there that were smoking like 12 old steam trains from the Paddington Station. It was ridiculous, like, you know. And this woman stood up anyway. And she read this poem, and I've ever since, this was 35 years ago, and it was a woman that read it, but it's actually called The Man in the Glass. When you get what you want in your struggle for self, and the world makes you king for a day, just go to a mirror and look at yourself and see what that man has to say. For it isn't your father or mother or wife whose judgment upon you must pass. That fellow whose lovely counts most in your life is the man looking back from the glass. He's a fellow to please, never mind all the rest, who is with you right up to the end, and you'll pass the most dangerous, difficult test. The man in the glass is your friend. You may fool the whole world on the pathways of years, and get pats on the back as you pass, but your final reward would be heartache and tears. If you have cheated the man in the glass. I'm trying to write it. Sounded as a more.
Thank you. Now, ladies and gentlemen, there's been a lot of laughter tonight, but I'm going to put a stop to all that. I have here a most gruesome tale. Oh, gruesome. It's set in the Irish famine, believe it or not. And it's very appropriate on this International Women's Day, because this scene I'm reading is about two sisters, and they've just discovered their parents in the mountains. Their parents are dead. Afraid. And the dogs are everywhere and they're starving. Told you this is no hayride. Anyway, see what you make of it. Ellie is the elder sister, and Deirdre is a bit more frightened than her. Ellie is the stronger kind of. They've come into the mountains, and they see the bodies of the parents and the dogs all around. As soon as
soon as the dogs saw the two sisters, they started barking at them, showing their fangs, their snouts covered in blood. "We can't go down there," Deirdre said, backing away. Ellie turned and looked for a moment back down the mountain and wished that there was some way they wouldn't have to face this. For a moment, she almost did give in to the temptation to run away, but some superstition inside her told her that this was something that could not be run away from. If she turned her back on this, she would leave part of herself behind too. The mangled, unburied bodies of their parents would grow in her memory, like evening shadows that elongate when the sun shifts downwards. They must stand up now, while there was still light, or they would be haunted forever by the horror. "No," Ellie said, "we're going down." "At least let us wait until the dogs are gone," Deirdre cried. "No," Ellie said, squeezing her sister's hand so tightly that Deirdre cried out in pain. "There will be nothing left to bury if we wait." Deirdre was trembling and pale-faced and looked incapable of doing anything. Ellie decided in that moment that she would do it alone if she had to, or die in the attempt. She looked down into the incline at the bodies, almost unrecognizable now. She felt a wave of nausea, but she fought it back. It was only death after all. She had seen starved human corpses in ditches many times. It was a common sight. She'd seen dead sheep and hares and rabbits torn to pieces. Death was part of the cycle, part of nature. It was bloody and unsightly, but then so too was birth. This burial was more important than life or death to her now. This was herself, her soul. They must go down and bury their parents. Ellie, in a sudden wild moment of decision, gripped Deirdre's arm and pulled her down the incline towards the dogs. As they drew nearer, Ellie gripped the shovel tightly, desperately. "Now," she shouted, breaking into a run right into the pack of dogs, striking at them in wild sweeping arcs with the shovel. She made contact again and again, knocking several of them senseless on the ground. Some of the dogs came back at her, rushing in beneath her ragged skirt, trying to bite her ankles, but she struck with an energy, a savagery that was not her own. Deirdre finally joined in, beating at the dogs with the stick. The dogs, who had partly satisfied their hunger, drew back. Perhaps they retreated because they were startled at the wildness, the savage determination of Ellie, who kept coming at them, clearly never going to give up. Or perhaps it was when they saw Deirdre join her sister and start attacking them with the heavy stick. Whatever it was, they retreated even further, though still snarling and still showing their teeth. Two sisters, their hair disheveled, stood back to back, a wild look on their faces, ready to face the dogs if they attacked again. The dogs kept their distance. After several minutes, Ellie, moving very slowly, very cautiously, afraid to take her eyes off the dogs for even a second, finally left Deirdre to keep an eye on them. And she started digging. Deirdre stood guard, gripping the heavy stick in readiness in case the dogs came back. After a while, a crow swept to the ground, and with its wings outspread, ready to take flight if the need arose, stepped curiously towards the bodies. Another, taking courage from the first, landed, then another. "Deirdre," Ellie shouted, "the crows!" Deirdre ran, waving the stick and shaking her ragged apron at them. The crows cawed and, spreading their bony black wings in dismay, fluttered back to the branches. Like all the creatures still left alive in the Valley of Trasna, they too were starved. Oh my God. It's over. you've done your bit for Lent, you are forgiven. And now with more laughter, hopefully, Seamus Harrington.
Thanks, Joe. This is continued from last week. It was called Memo from Heaven, and it was a memo concerning the kind of footwear to be worn if you were going up to the pearly gates. And it stopped halfway through. So, for those of you in possession of a current dog license and canine cert for a clean bill of health, brown hush puppies, okay. No pets, no sponsors. Camels and needles, no shoe-ins. No leprechauns, shoes, sneakers, or bound feet. No galoshes, sandals, or hobnail boots. These will normally be greeted by a slow wing beat from the shed end. No, you may not hire, this is not a bowling alley. Moccasins, cloth soles with recycled tires, and pooties and winkle pickers allowed for use only by ethnic groups. No asbestos suit to be worn going into a coffin or body bag. Who knows where it may end up? In the event of being able to prove that this is your normal apparel on call, this rule may be waived. However, if disproved, the zip will be opened midway, 3 drops of fast-setting glue applied, and the remains will be sent back to Earth in a clear plastic bag. Anybody applying for a crematorium after the electric chair may claim a singe benefit. This is very serious. This equates to a discount of 9.1%. Anybody applying for a crematorium when laid out in an asbestos suit will be surcharged 9.061%. Anybody not complying with these regs may be sentenced to a further spell in purgatory for incineration, or a fine of 9.3 months salary, pension, plus penalties, and be tied by the ankles to a self-erecting crane. No, bungee cord will not be used. Goals and other types of the undead. This is not your stuff. If you show up here, instant repatriation, no waiting list. The new prefab annex to your right, next to the hospitality suite, is a preliminary health check screening facility. If you can produce at least 3 means of identity and incontrovertible proof that this is your 3rd reincarnation, an exemption may be granted and you may be allowed, if Veruca free, to take part barefooted. Mind the step. The toll free wicket gate is a new development and trial run. Delays of up to 20 minutes may occur. Single file, please. Take a ticket and wait your turn to be here locked in. No tailgating. No pass-outs. I have no doubt you will see these cost-cutting measures, efficiencies, as necessary. When my boss, the first Undersecretary to St. Peter, returns from paternity leave, the situation may be subjected to a further review. All Souls Day, circular number 33. This notice supersedes all other memorandum. This notice is to be printed A3, laminated and displayed in a pale wood frame in morgues, crematoria, funeral parlours, church porches, libraries, community halls, houses of ill repute, and sub post offices. This notice is dated 8th of March 2010. Thank you.
Trisha Walsh. Thank you, Joe. This one is called Walk Your Starlight. It's raining again tonight. To add insult to injury, just before I enter the footpath, avoid the wild infection that is caught by Will. If It's a long time since I saw the stars arise as Sirius, calmly waiting until I turned my attention skywards. But in the youthful light of the city, I beckon to wait, just in case. Voting is not available here to select your preparation of missions. Whatever happens, like the light away, let the shards descend upon me as rain persists. This is called goodbye. After several meetings in the shopping mall, we cemented our acquaintance. Sleight of eye and tactile twist of fate, we dispose of time as we see fit, forgetting our place in the universe. Or empty the attack bay, it's not your fault that the cafe is full of undead. Being that there is more to life than newspaper, and that my void won't fill itself, dog is not back to you, goodbye. This is called Dancing Concrete. Pirouetting on parkour, when you fall hard. You might even break your knee. I avoid your gaze, you swing me like a weapon around the dance floor. I ask, or make you so angry. You answer, silent, blunt. Feet perfectly tied, now answer as we, exhaled, pursued by a fire. Cold and deep, slipping the mask, pirouetting on hardcore. When you fall hard. You might even break your knee. Thank you.
And O'Donnell O'Callaghan.
Good evening. This road stone ball, also known as the concrete ball. This place too had one time been a lime tree ball, or at least had been a beech tree one, where every poet's blackbird without fail sang up its praises every morning, then sang it down to sleep each night, leaving all to silence, but for an occasional wader booted step of he who coached the nearby river, or the sound of the leaf litter rustle when shadowy night things came out to forage. But then one morning, as some of us had feared, the chainsaws came, all snarl and shriek in their blue smoke frenzy. They bit, their bite proving far much worse than the beech tree's bark, into which they bit and ripped and spat, until they brought the whole place down around our ears. The yellow-beaked blackbird now being replaced by the yellow-necked diggers, who served us up a different kind of tune. One that we had come to learn by wallet, if not by heart, this roadstone bower. Yes, into which he walks through now, waderless and rodless, his cover blown, a hand on saddle wheeling, the green metal sandbins stripping their Sunday silence by the zinc iron covered warehouse that sprawls with reams and rolls of rust brown mesh, idle coiled along its shaded length. Meanwhile, a woman out upon her Sunday walk comes to a nervous halt some distance off. The eyeballs dip and stone, moves off a harmless tangent to the quadrant of her fear, hand on saddle wheeling. After brisk good evenings are exchanged, the mind is triggered quick onto another track, and passing by the canteen shed, a wheelie bin marked litter beckons, spoon-pressed tea bags, crushed milk cartons, sliced pan wrappers, ashtray buttons, but nothing dirty there. A pang of shame then prods them sharply back on track, back onto some sightings more mundane. A big old rusting makeshift gantry, rigged with steps and rails, catwalks, props, beams and stays, up and over, down and under, back and crossways running, funnels, hoppers, crisscross elevators, painted all the green, as if to make them look like all what they have replaced. Ah yes, the crow never caught upon a pylon strut, but is there all a poetry, I'd like to know? And then, perched on the rim of a nearby bin, a fellow crow called back, and heck, why not? Sure aren't we a class of blackbird too? No sound is dissonant which tells of life. For you see, some day, down there that feathered dynapiece, this stuff too may also get a chance to grow old and venerable, and therefore attractive in that kind of cultural heritage kind of way, just like that gunpowder mill downstream, or the city jail a few miles further in, or 100 other such like one-time grey grim places. And then you'll see the tourists will come round, no doubt by the boatload then, and their guide will say how way back in the last ice age, when this world still had polar caps and bears had fur to keep them warm, the natives made their sewer pipes here, and water pipes, and land drain pipes, and toxic chemical pipes, and how some local minor poet, alas long since forgotten, sang its praises in lines such as these ones here, this old stone bower. A vision of transcendence in a corrugated iron public barn on the Sheepshead Way. As the jukebox in the glim-lit corner began to crank out Sancho live at the RKO, he took an iron bar at length and held it up to the dust-mote light that streamed in through the pop-holed corrugated roof. Question. Ever been struck by an iron bar? Well then, you've not been living, man. For an iron bar is very striking. For so it is that I've been struck. Especially too, if it happens to be a rusty bar. Yes, with a grizzle of rust all over. And what's this rust when it's out? It's oxidization, man. Yes. When the clay-born spirits of iron join and make light with the spirits of air. Of course, to try and remedy this, our friends the rule-bound engineers advise a coat or two of best red lead, a heavier metal still. But still, in spite of all these primer coats and undercoats and finish coats, that rust will break on through every time given time, and we've got all together now, all of the time in the world. Thank you.
Thanks, Donald. That was lovely. Sue Coltrane.
I just have to apologize to those who heard this song before, because I was just at Big City. Hours ago, and I read it there. So, it's a poem about invisible lines, lines that connect space and divide spaces from each other. Something I was born in Russia, and then I lived in Iraq for some years, and I left there just after the start of the Iran-Iraq war. And there's line, the geographic line, the longitude 44 degrees east, which runs right from the border of the two countries. And it also runs through a city in northern Russia called Arkhangelsk, which is Archangel, and lots of the weapons were manufactured there for use in the war. So this is called Longitude 44 degrees east. Outside is a sub-zero Arkhangelsk night, home from bursting the tank at Arkhangelsk. Your skin sags an arm's length away from me within a white and dual canvas deck chair. All around us in the snow blinkered tundra, a distillation of barrenness from emptiness, our ancient killing fields. They lie fallow, moribund, beneath a cruel crystalline blanket. Nothing stirs here, not even the guinea, whose primordial rage blazes inwards. Naphtalim, it courses through his marrow, burning him from within. Even Lady Aurora, for whom he had waited all night, cannot save him. There she flirts, Eborealis as she made across the sky, Russian knight's cheek with her emerald hem. Neither maiden nor hag, but a hologram, an empty promise of dead photons. My heart is a blood-speckled icicle, Yevgeny bemoans, while I, skin tall to the blood flow of a sun-worshipping village, count the seconds that measure the distance between tenderness and forgetfulness. How can I not long for my home, 2,000 miles due south, where I once frolicked, incandescent in the noonday sun? There, across an invisible divide, men see crimson flowers in the desert sand. At first light, black birds will peck the seed of light. Thank you.
Lovely.
Now I see Alan Tipsy looking youthful, getting ready for his trip to China. And I'd like to invite Alan to come up and let loose.
thank you, Joe. I'm going to read a poem, a short poem in Irish, which is about the twisted timber of humanity or something like that. If you don't get it, it's too fucking bad. It's actually very good along the way, and maybe a story after that. It's the Irish poet's Conley Bogarty. Winning crown macht and creve, Quirin gwydio'r eich yn aimod, siol yn aimod rôl y sfeira, gwyn y sferach ydw'r chela, celiwr yn chantyn ys o'n sefa, sel i'ch poest i grein a tairfwra, taid i'ch sir o gwyd ys has, na desig yn dweanach sy'n y ddes, eich i'ch amach yn lŷn i irach, dîfri gybrach yn tysgynt i anus, ŵnr fawr y garbs gyffyrta, o nirin y lawns yn teach neata, nadig y dain yn polgus rawng, mae'r falat yr chrynus colog lawn, Nú bu cumar is casca fíor go bhais go ras nám rí an chiel. That's it really. You can clap if you want to. this is a story. I may have read it here, but I certainly read it at the Frank O'Connor short story competition. It's quite short. It's called A Cure for Love. Some of you will be interested in this. This poor unfortunate was in love. He knew this because his hands were shaking and his knees were weak and he couldn't seem to stand on his own 2 feet. The woman knew this also, as women do, but her heart was cold as a grave, or else she was in love with somebody else. One way or the other, she more or less disdainfully ignored him, or would merely deign to allow her left earlobe incline in his direction. Patience, time and tide, and space and distance, his friends would tell him, because most of them had been through this particular mill, as men do. But he wrote to an agony aunt, but she wasn't much better. How can I express my love for her, he had said, hoping for a clear answer. It doesn't matter how you express it, she replied, so long as you practice safe sex. You can't be too careful these days. And how shall I approach her, he had asked, hoping for some useful advice. The most common way is from the front, she replied, but there are many books which suggest alternatives. You could, of course, kill yourself, suggested a friend, who, although he was happily married, had failed in his attempts 3 times. In the end, he decided to go to Dr. Psycho, who knew all the answers. Oh, doctor, I'm in trouble, he said, and poured forth his story. Well, yes, said Dr. Psycho, after he'd listened to him several times and walked around the table, I recognize the symptoms all right. A racing pulse, dizziness in the head, music in the ears, a pale face, a faraway look in the eyes, trembling fingers. I have no doubt that you are suffering from toefuls, or totally obsessed and fucked up love syndrome. But what's the cure, he begged. What am I to do? I'll tell you what you do, said Psycho, in measured and professional tones. Get up and go out of this office. Find a white cat who has a wart on his tail. Cut it out with a blackthorn knife. Cut it exactly into 2 halves and sprinkle it with the juice of a newt's eye and a jam of a frog's toe. Boil it slowly in an oyster shell which has been salvaged from a rusty wreck in the Straits of Gibraltar. Go out to a hazel wood when the fire is in your head. Eat 1 half slowly, chewing it on the right-hand side of your mouth only, Then throw the others over your left shoulder in a northwesterly direction just as the sun is going down. Then run home as fast as your legs will carry you and bury your head beneath the blankets. He was listening carefully to Psycho all this time, listening to his smooth, calm, professional tone and his reassuring voice. "And are you telling me that this will cure my love sickness?" he asked, between hope and credulity. "Well, I'm not saying it will cure it precisely," said the doctor, "but it will do as much good as any fucking else he will try."